It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a new report finds only about 1 in 10 of Wisconsin's legislative districts had competitive elections last year. We'll find out why.
But first, this is the Wisconsin Public Radio Spring Membership Drive. Veronica Rickert here with Chris Molina. You count on WPR for great discussions, and it's your gift of any amount that makes these discussions possible. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And Veronica, we heard from 12 listeners last hour. Thank you so much for those pledges. This hour, we're looking to hear from about 10 listeners. These hourly goals are important because they help us stay on track financially so we can keep the discussion going strong here on Central Time and on Wisconsin Public Radio. So please take a moment right now and give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
As a public radio listener, you're smart. You want to know what's going on both in news and in the culture around us, and we're right there with you, exploring all the angles here on Central Time.
We're so grateful for your support. It makes all the stories you hear on this show possible. Give now. It makes a huge difference at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You give to WPR to support the programs that you love. And as an added incentive, we've got something special during the spring membership drive. When you pledge $60 or more, that's $5 a month, you can ask for the I Love WPR magnets.
Yeah, they're really cool. You get one large magnet, one small magnet. You can stick them on your car, on your refrigerator, anywhere that's got that magnetic surface. Show your WPR pride. Ask for the magnets now. Show your support when you make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Here's something to know. A large slice of WPR's budget pie, in fact, the biggest slice, is listener support. So while all of our funding sources, the state and federal governments and business are important, your contribution makes a huge difference. WPR is the amazing service that it is thanks to listener support. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
When you first became a regular listener to Wisconsin Public Radio, you took an important first step. Now, take the next step and become a financial supporter.
The step from listener to supporter, it's an easy one. Decide how much you'd like to give. $5 a month is a great starting point. And then make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we're looking to hear from about 10 listeners this hour, and we've got about 15 minutes left to get those pledges. Your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 really does help.
Don't forget, this pledge drive, we're offering something special. Show your support of WPR with the I Love WPR magnets. They're yours for a pledge of $5 a month, $60 or more. Anyone who sees them will say, hey, you support Wisconsin Public Radio. That's pretty cool. Well, you can do that and get those magnets for $60 or more at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And if you're not already a sustaining member of Wisconsin Public Radio, it is a great time to become one. It's easy to set up. You just set up convenient ongoing monthly donations from your bank account or your credit card. You tell us the amount that you want to pledge, and then you do it. Become a sustainer. It'll come out of your bank account or the credit card every month. No paper renewals. You don't have to worry about it. Just set it and forget it. But you can only do it with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You can join Gary and Jean from Slinger, who donated and said, we donate every year, and the email we received reminded us that it was time to send another contribution. Jean from Green Bay says, WPR is my source for clear, unbiased, and broad-based news. WPR is deserving of my support. Sound familiar? A couple reasons there why people give. Why do you give? Make that decision now. Think about what matters most to you about WPR, and then make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your pledge right now makes such a huge difference during the spring membership drive, and not only makes programs like Central Time possible, but all the great programs you hear on the weekend. Maybe you love Laughing Along with Michael Feldman or Zorba Pastor on the weekend. Maybe you love Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me or Car Talk. Your pledge of any amount, let's say $5 a month, $10 a month, it makes all of these great programs programs possible. We couldn't do it without you, the listeners. You are the public in Wisconsin Public Radio. Make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
The great part is a pledge of any amount matters, and it really does make a difference. Whatever amount feels right to you, well, that's the right amount. The important thing is to make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you so much for your support.
If you voted in a state legislative race during last year's elections, there's a good chance that the election was decided before you even cast your vote.
That's the takeaway from a new report out this week, which found that only 1 in 10 legislative districts here in Wisconsin were competitive in the last round of elections, which is a sharp drop from previous years. And our next guest is concerned about what that means for our politics and for the future of the state.
Joining us now is Jay Heck, Executive Director of Common Cause in Wisconsin. Jay, welcome back to the show.
Rob, it's great to be with you again. Thanks for inviting me.
So just 10% of legislative races competitive in 2014. Does that come as a surprise to you?
Well, it's pretty pathetic, isn't it? It's hardly what you would expect in a vibrant democracy. The problem is that I don't think people really realize this, but, you know, we have 99 assembly seats, 33 state Senate seats, so that's 132 legislative seats. Half the state Senate was up in 2014, all 99 assembly seats, and only 9 of 99 assembly seats, less than 10% of assembly seats, were considered competitive, and only 3 of 16 state Senate seats. And by competitive, what we're talking about is elections where the result was 55% to 45% or less.
So a 10% margin or less makes it competitive.
Well, yes, and that's even pretty generous. Some people wouldn't even consider a 55-45 race to be very close.
Now, has it been this way for a long time, or are things getting less competitive over time?
They're getting worse, and I would assert that they are a result of the 2011 redistricting process here in Wisconsin. By contrast, in 2010, before the gerrymandering in 2011, it wasn't that there was a great number. It was about 25% of all state legislative seats were competitive. But we dropped from 25% down to about 15% in 2012 to a paltry 10% in 2014. And what that suggests is that the lines were rigged in such a way that there really aren't contests in the general election, that the legislators have chosen who their voters are rather than the voters being able to choose who their state legislators are.
Well, let's talk about what that means for different interested parties here, and let's start with the voters. If I'm a voter in this district where party X is almost certainly going to win, what does that mean for me?
Well, it means that in the general election, almost regardless of what you decide to do, the outcome is preordained. We know, for instance, in certain seats in Madison and Milwaukee, that a Democrat's always going to be elected. We also know that in certain seats in the Fox Valley or in rural Wisconsin, a Republican's going to be elected. But there used to be in Wisconsin a lot of seats that where there was competition, that there was a real vibrant contest to win the hearts and minds of voters in order to win the election. But with gerrymandering and redistricting, what's happened is that Democrats have been packed into fewer districts. Republicans, who controlled the process in 2011, have made it so that they have a better advantage in other districts. And as a result, we have a largely unresponsive legislature, because if you have a saved seat and you don't have to worry about your reelection chances, except in the partisan primary, then you're going to ignore a lot of the concerns of many of the constituents that you may have.
Now, I wanted to ask about the politician, the candidate side of things. Do we get different people elected, first of all, because of this, and do we get different behavior from the people we elect in these non-competitive races?
Yes, and that's really what the problem is. The problem is that we tend to elect the real, not the radicals, but the really hardcore Republicans, the far-right Republicans, and on the Democratic Party, often the far-left. And so what you have is you have less ability for legislators of differing views to come together to forge a compromise. And in Wisconsin, which is a 50-50 state, for years, that's how we conducted the business of state government: bipartisanship, compromise. working out the differences and coming to a consensus. We don't see that in the state very much anymore. And I would assert that it's in large part because of partisan redistricting.
See, but can't the parties tackle this problem if you've got a Republican hardcore district? And as you say, they're running somebody further to the right. If I'm the Democrats, why don't I find somebody at the center right, and eventually the balance is going to right itself. We can be competitive. Same thing if I'm a Republican looking at a liberal district, I'm going to run a moderate to liberal version of Republican to try to get that. Why can't that sort itself out that way?
Because in the primaries, which are lower voter turnout than general elections, that's when the hardcore partisan voters come out. And generally, they're going to want to elect a true blue conservative, a true red conservative Republican, or a real liberal Democrat, as opposed to a moderate of either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. So it's the winner is often determined in the primary election as opposed to the general election. And that's just bad for democracy.
So what would be a solution? What would you like to see happen here?
The solution would be to do what our neighbor in Iowa does, and that is have a system where the legislative and congressional districts are drawn not by partisan legislators, but by a nonpartisan entity that is charged with strict criteria for drawing the lines. For instance, keeping cities and counties together. Squares are nice. Rectangles are good, not snakes and slivery lines like we see in Wisconsin. The other thing is not to take past partisan performance into account when you're drawing the lines, but rather just look at communities of interest and try to keep those together. You know, in some cities, small cities in Wisconsin like Beloit or Sheboygan, the cities are divided into three assembly districts. That makes absolutely no sense.
We're talking right now with Jay Heck of Common Cause in Wisconsin about the lack of competitive legislative districts in the state. Only about 10%, he says, in the last election had actual competitive races. We want to hear from you on this, too.
As a voter, how do you feel about the lack of competitive state elections? What are the consequences, do you think, good or bad? And would you support redistricting reform to change things? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking right now with Jay Heck of Common Cause in Wisconsin, who just put out a new report which finds that only 1 in 10 state legislative elections were competitive in 2014. He's concerned about what that means for Wisconsin's voters, for Wisconsin's politics in general. You could join in with your questions and your comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jay, thanks for your pledge, first of all, and we'll get to our callers now. We've got Mark on the line in Appleton. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
So I looked at the 2012 election a couple of years ago, and I counted up the number of votes that were cast in the entire assembly, all the assembly races. And what I found was that there were, for about every 10,000 votes that were required to win a Republican seat, it required about 17,000 votes to win a Democratic seat. And I'm wondering if your guest has a possible system that could work to smooth that out a bit.
Well, good question. And it's true that because of gerrymandering, because of PAC districts, you could, as a whole in a state, have more votes for one party, but they would win fewer seats because they're able to pack all the, in this case in Wisconsin, the Republicans packed the Democrats into just a fewer seats than the Republicans were able to control. And, you know, the key is, I think, it ought to be, the districts ought to be drawn without regard to partisan political consideration. That's the fairest way. I think what you want to do is you want to keep communities of interest together, as I said before, and counties together. Now, that may be, for instance, that you'll have some counties that will be, you know, will go Republican and some will go Democratic. But in those areas where there tends to be a nice mix of people, you'll have truly competitive elections. And it sort of sorts itself out that way. I don't think you want to deliberately draw maps in such a way that you're going to have a specific outcome. But I do think you want to take political considerations out of drawing the maps. And by the way, the Democrats, when they were in power, they didn't accomplish redistricting reform. The Republicans over the past 4 years have refused to even hold a public hearing on it. Nevertheless, there's a lot more people in Wisconsin that are aware of this issue now, and I think are starting to tell their legislators that they're demanding action before 2021, which is when the next redistricting process occurs.
But it seems like this is a bipartisan issue. Each party hopes they're going to be the ones who draws the map next time around. They don't want to ruin the chance of doing that. Even with some voter interest in this issue? Do you really see something happening?
Well, the thing is that we're doing it now. It's 2015, right? And this process is not in place until 2021. So it's 6 years away. Some of the folks that are in the legislature now won't be there in 2021. And what we're looking for is real leadership. You know, whenever you have great reform of any kind, it's because there are a couple of folks, a couple of legislators who are brave enough to stand up to their partisan political interests and their party leaders and do the right thing. And so what we need are legislators to come forward. And we've had some of those types of legislators of both political parties. Former State Senator Dale Schultz, who retired last year, was a strong advocate for redistricting reform, as was former State Senator Tim Cullen, a Democrat. But there are people in the legislature now. The key is that the legislators need to hear from their constituents and say, this is something that we want and we need before 2021.
Mark, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Mike in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you think about this?
I was having a discussion probably about a week ago on the same thing, and I was looking at the redistricted map, not just from Wisconsin, but from all across the country. And just like the spider line and the little fractured districts that they've redrawn are, I mean, I don't know how anybody can look at that and say that that's a fair demographic for a specific district. And in terms of trying to find a unbiased, nonpartisan, you know, group or entity to actually provide the services to create these new districts, I don't think there is one. I mean, how can there be? Because if that's the case, it's going to have to be appointed by somebody, either a governor, either a legislation, or a legislator. Somebody is going to have to appoint these, and there's always going to be that kind of a bias. Is there a way, or is there somehow that maybe the people can say it? And if you go to do redistricting, it has to then come up to a vote.
Mike, thanks for the call. You know, with the Government Accountability Board, Jay, that was supposed to be an impartial thing. Well, people have been critical. So how do you pick an impartial third party to set these redistricting districts?
Well, with regard to the GAB, it is impartial, and that's why they're being attacked, because partisans want to make it more partisan. But with regard to doing this, that's why we like the Iowa system, because in Iowa, it's the Legislative Service Bureau that draws the lines, and they are charged with strict criteria on how to draw the lines. And the criteria says that you cannot look at past election results. You can't even consider where the legislator's hometown is when you draw these lines. They have to be drawn in order to keep communities of interest together, to try to keep counties together, to try to have basic sense out of the geography. And that's why we like that model. And the result, if you look at the result, they've instituted this in 1980. The results of that have been very competitive elections at both the congressional and the state legislative level in Iowa. Most importantly, the people in Iowa have confidence in the system. There are no lawyers involved. There's no cost to the taxpayers. The biggest cost in Iowa is to rent vans to take the Legislative Service Bureau personnel around to three public hearings around the state to hear talk from citizens. In Wisconsin, we've spent over $2 million in taxpayer funds to draw more partisan lines with less competition and more suspicion. So I think Iowa is a great model for Wisconsin, and it's also something that would stand a constitutional challenge.
Jay, as we wrap up, you know, potholes, crime, taxes, government services, these are things that people are motivated to vote by. Are people going to be motivated to vote and to lobby their representatives for redistricting reform?
Well, I think increasingly they are, because I think a lot of citizens understand that unless you have fair voting maps, that elections become sort of meaningless. They become preordained, and you're never going to get the kinds of results in the issues you care about, whether it's, you know, property tax relief or the environment or anything else. You're never going to get any of those things until you have a fair system under which people are elected. And we do see rising support for redistricting reform. And if you just go to our website, commoncausewisconsin.org, there's a place that you can sign an online petition and let Wisconsin legislators know you support this reform.
Jay, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That's Jay Heck, Executive Director of Common Cause in Wisconsin. Join us to talk about the lack of competitive legislative districts. A new report shows that here in the state.
Coming up after the news, we talk with Sir Ken Robinson, whose TED Talk on creativity and education remains the most watched of all time. He'll share his vision for transforming schools to focus on the needs of each learner.
And remember, it's our pledge drive. Pledge in support of these great conversations right now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. More to come on Central Time. Do schools kill creativity? When creativity expert Sir Ken Robinson first asked this question in a 2006 TED Talk, it soon became the most watched TED Talk of all time, and it remains so to this day.
Robinson was knighted by the British government for his research on creativity in education. He says the education system is failing students who have to compete in an increasingly global and digital age.
Robinson says our current emphasis on testing comes at the cost of creativity. He makes the case for revolutionizing education to focus on individual students and spark their innate talent and their curiosity.
Joining us now is Sir Ken Robinson, author of several books on creativity and education, including the latest, Creative Schools, the Grassroots Revolution That's Transforming Education. Sir Ken, welcome to the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, your 2006 TED Talk asked if schools kill creativity. Your answer in a nutshell, yes, lots of education does. And it was the most viewed TED Talk ever. Why do you think it hit such a nerve?
I think because people recognize from their own education and the education of their children that they have talents that school didn't discover and didn't cultivate, and that it's important that they should. I should also say, by the way, that I had a huge response to the talk and to the work I do from teachers themselves and from school principals and school districts, because very often they feel that they're being frustrated in their attempts to give this education the sort of creative turn it really needs, that they're being frustrated by this culture of standardization. So it wasn't an attack on schools at all. It was really, if anything, it was a defense of them.
Part of the reason that you say schools can kill creativity is because we're working off a model that grew out of the Industrial Revolution. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are a couple of strands to it. One is that public education as we know it now didn't really exist much before, in most countries, before the middle of the 19th century, and in some a bit later than that. These mass systems of education were developed at the height of industrialism, and it was to help supply, among other things, a workforce for the industrial economy. It's why we had such a broad base of elementary education, such a narrow base of university education. It was a model of the workforce we needed. It was largely manual with some professional and clerical people at the top. And the school system itself is modeled to some extent on the lines of industrial production. If you think of it, you know, we educate children by ages in batches. They go through the system in regular cohorts, you know, all the 8-year-olds together, all the 9-year-olds together. The day gets broken up into bits in high schools, into 40, 50-minute periods, and bells ring. We end up taking these things for granted, but really these sorts of organizational techniques aren't necessary for good learning or good education. In some ways, actually get in the way of it. I mean, you can imagine, couldn't you, if you're running a business on that basis where every 40 minutes everybody had to stop what they were doing and go to some other room and do something else, you'd be bankrupt in a week. And it doesn't really help learning either very much. So there are organizational features which are rooted in the industrial efficiency model. But also there's a hierarchy of subjects in schools which is related to what we think are going to be subjects most useful for getting work. And that hierarchy is also very questionable. And I suppose the last thing to say is that increasingly, since No Child Left Behind became the law here in America, there's a tremendous pressure of standardization and of relentless testing in schools. And that's really, I think, started to have damaging effects on the quality and nature of learning. And it's largely, in many ways, proven to be counterproductive.
Well, I want to get to that standardized testing. But first, you say that to get at how education should be reformed, we have to figure out what we think it's actually for. What is your answer to that question?
Well, education is one of those areas, you know, that raises the temperature in conversations very often, and there are good reasons for it, because we're very invested in it for ourselves, our children. There are all kinds of reasons why education matters. But it's one of those ideas, a bit like democracy and freedom and independence, where we all think we know what we mean about it. We assume we agree until we start to talk about it and realize we have slightly different interpretations, sometimes radically different interpretations. Education's like that. For some people, it's all about getting a job. For some people, it's all about social control and things of that sort. So I argue in the book that before we can really talk about the sort of education we want, we at least ought to be clear what we mean by it and if we mean different things. My take on it is that education has a twin role, that it should help young people, or people of any age, discover the talents they have inside of them, and help them understand the world around them so that they can be fulfilled individuals and active and compassionate citizens. I think all that matters. We want people to leave school and go on to other education or to work, feeling confident in their own talents and abilities and able to be productive and engaged in their communities. But we also want people to be compassionate towards others and to be active in the well-being of communities and economically productive. So it's a broad range of things that education has to achieve. And for that reason, we need a broad curriculum and we need to be flexible in the way we set about educating people in our schools. And at the moment, the testing culture tends to limit things on all those fronts.
Well, right now, the United States, as you know, is having a rough time grappling with problems like the achievement gap and failing schools. And one proposed solution has been to come up with models for standardization, like at its basis, Common Core, No Child Left Behind. What do you think about that model of reform, trying to make sure that all kids get more or less the same information and knowledge and then using a standardized test to make sure?
Well, you know, it's all very well intentioned. There's no question about that. I work with school districts all across the country. I've lived here for about 15 years now. I've spoken with senior politicians of all parties, and I've no doubt of people's goodwill and good intentions. And No Child Left Behind, which is being reauthorized as we speak, is also full of all the right language. The problem is the strategy that's been adopted, which, as you say, is largely about standardizing and testing. And you have to separate things out a bit here. There's a big debate on just now about the Common Core. I mean, broadly speaking, I think there are good reasons to have a general agreement on the sorts of things that we ought to learn in common. I mean, for example, in mathematics and in some other disciplines, in languages, we don't need to keep inventing these things. There's some value in saying, well, can't we agree on these at least that we ought to be covering? The testing issue is something a bit different. The No Child Left Behind provided or required that schools and districts have regular tests, particularly in languages and science and mathematics. And the consequence has been that these tests are called high-stakes tests for a good reason, that they can affect funding, they can affect teachers' employment, they can affect whether principals are kept on or dismissed, and they affect resources for schools. It's become very competitive. And the result is that in practice in schools, kids spend a huge amount of time now either being tested or being prepared to be tested or being debriefed on the tests. Teachers spend hours and hours of time administering these tests, following up from the tests. It's become a testing culture, and parents don't like it, teachers don't like it, kids are being disengaged and disaffected by it. And it's also worth saying, Veronica, as I say in the book, this is a big business. This isn't just some benign process that well-intentioned educators have agreed to do to help standards go up. That may be the underlying idea, but this is a multi-billion-dollar industry. It's huge profits for private companies. It's one of the figures we found as we're looking at through this is that the NFL, the National Football League, in 2013, had overall receipts of about $9 billion. That's a big business. The U.S. domestic cinema box office was $11 billion. That's a big business, but the testing and educational support industry in the U.S. had receipts of over $16 billion. That's massive. And a lot of that goes to private companies. It's unregulated. There's more regulation in the production of pet food than there is in the testing industry in schools. And the result is it's narrowed the curriculum, and it's subverted the quality of education. It's not even raising standards in the way that people expected it would. And the reason is that education is a personal business. You know, it shouldn't be a steeplechase. It's about finding people's talents and unleashing the energies of schools so they can really encourage individual achievement and collective and collaborative work. And the book is, by the way, full of examples of schools that are doing that and getting much better results.
And you're saying you want a revolution based on that idea, the belief in the value of the individual. What does that look like?
It's not just the individual. I'm talking about I think what it comes to is this initially is that all children are different. That's the point. You know, this isn't a manufacturing process. It's a human process. If anybody listening to this thinks about their own children, you know, if they've got two or more, or even know of two or more children, I bet you they're completely different from each other. You know, you and I, you know, we have a lot in common by virtue of being, you know, human beings and living on the planet and sharing certain cultural backgrounds. But we're all different. You know, we have different talents, different interests. Human life is about diversity, and the standards culture is about conformity. And so part of my argument, yes, is that we should recognize that these are real people being educated. They have interests and ambitions and hopes and aspirations, and we have to engage that for education to be successful for them. There's one example I'll just give you quickly is of a school. There are lots in the book. I mean, the book, it's not a theoretical book. I'm always very keen to say that. There are lots of good ideas, I hope, in the book that people will find interesting and inspiring, but it's really a book of practice and evidence. There's a school, for example, that we talk about in Georgia. It's called Smoky Road. It's a middle school, which had a bad reputation for a long time. Kids were regularly not showing up at school. There were lots of problems in the school when they did. And they had a new head teacher come in, Dr. Laurie Barron, who, she said, spent the first year jumping over desks and breaking up fights pretty much. But then she and the teachers started to form a plan and work with the parents and the governor and the community, and they decided that really what they had to do was to get to know these kids properly and engage them properly. And as you put it, we realized that what mattered most to these kids is what really mattered. So there was one girl she talked about who loved music but really wasn't getting that kind of music education she needed in school. And so they helped her with that. They provided for it. And, I mean, she got much more involved and her grades overall improved. There's a lad who she said was a statistic waiting to happen at the age of 13. But football was his thing, but he wasn't really being encouraged. So they did, and they engaged him in that. And she said over time, they did this with all the kids, and they found that if they engaged children in things they loved to do and what mattered to them, then they were much more likely to do the things that mattered to everybody else. And anyway, the school has become very successful. Attendance rates have gone right up. Achievement rates have improved. Test results have improved. There's a great atmosphere there. And Laurie herself was recognized as the MetLife Middle School Principal of the Year. Now, what it shows is that education is a human, personal process. And if you engage people at that level, you get much better results than if you disengage them through this relentless process of standardization.
And we leave it there. Sir Ken, thanks so much for talking today.
It's my great pleasure, Veronica. Thank you for having me on.
That was Sir Ken Robinson, creativity expert, author of several books on education, including his latest called Creative Schools.